right, please be seated. Good morning. We are here today for oral argument in State versus McBride. Could I start with your appearances? All right, good morning. 25 minutes followed by 30 and 5 minutes on rebuttal. Couple orders of business before we start up with your oral argument. Justices Dallet and Karofsky are appearing by telephone this morning, so I'll try to be aware if I hear some rumbling or seems like someone wants to ask a question. Justice Protasiewicz is not on this case today, so that sort of explains the empty chairs in different ways. And then we have a school with us this morning, Wisconsin Lutheran High School. Could you stand, please? It is great to see you. Welcome to Madison. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. You're here with Court with Class, so you know a little bit about this case, right? And now you'll hear the lawyers argue, and you'll hear us ask some questions about it this morning. But if you can stick around a little bit after oral argument, I'd be happy to meet with you for a few minutes and see if you have any questions, not about the case, but just about the court and how we operate, things like that. If you don't, that's fine too, but I'm available if you want to chat for a few minutes after oral argument today. Go ahead and have a seat. Nice to see you here. All right, then, with that, let's start up with oral argument. Mr. O'Day.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. At its most basic, this case is about how an appellate court reviews a circuit court's record. And to maintain the proper role of courts, this Court has consistently held that a circuit court's factual findings must be upheld unless there is an absence of support in the record. And in the context of the Fourth Amendment, this Court has consistently held that reasonable suspicion and probable cause are inquiries based on all, not some, all of the facts viewed as a cumulative whole. In this case, a majority of the Court of Appeal...
Well, is your statement of the standard of review outcome determinative here?
Can you rephrase the question,
well,
Mrs. Braley?
If you had stated the standard of review as we'll hold the findings of fact of a circuit court unless it is clearly erroneous, it is clearly erroneous if it misstates the facts or the law. And then the inquiry is, with that framework of analysis, is there a misstatement of facts? Your statement of our standard takes a little different approach, and that's why I ask if it's outcome determinative.
Your Honor, I think how... This Court has said that factual findings are not clearly erroneous unless they're against the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence, and that reviewing courts review the record for reasons to uphold a circuit court's factual findings. And I think that gets to the same result in how you pose the standard of review.
I don't. And I'll tell you why and then respond, if you will. If it's clearly erroneous, here you have... a record that has a video, of course, the recorder from the police, the recording from the police. And the Court of Appeals said, hey, I mean, they didn't say, hey, I mean, they said it in a much more formal way. But in essence, what we see belies the testimony of the officers. That's in essence what they said. So how do you deal with that? Are you asking, now I'm segueing, are you asking the court and the Court of Appeals to negate what apparently the Court of Appeals said they saw through their own eyes in looking at the video as to how it transpired. So
Justice Bradley, I think the video in this case, I don't think shows what the Court of Appeals' conclusion as clearly as the Court of Appeals thinks it does.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, because we have testimony from the officer, an arguably unclear video, we have a disputed fact about where the SUV was in the alley. So if there's a question on that fact, the circuit court settles that by exercising its fact-finding function, and the video here doesn't clearly show that the circuit court was wrong.
I don't want to take anyone's opportunity to ask a question, but I don't see any of my colleagues chomping at the bit, so to speak, so I'm going to...
Not yet,
okay. It's outcome determinative in this way. Essentially, you invoke, without saying it, the independent appellate review doctrine. If there's any evidence in the record to uphold the circuit court's finding, then that's what you do. That's the way you started out. And, of course, there's something in the record, the testimony of the officers, as to whether or not the vehicle blocked the roadway or the alleyway, et cetera. Right? So if you state it in that fashion, ipso facto, you prevail. If you state it in a different fashion, as I indicated, then not necessarily so. Am I making myself clear to you?
Is your point that that an appellate court isn't required to uphold an incorrect factual finding?
If the Court of Appeals, after viewing the video, finds the finding of fact, or it determines that the finding of fact is clearly erroneous, what do you do with that?
Well, in this case, even if the location of the circuit court's findings about the location of the SUV are clearly erroneous, we can still do a full reasonable suspicion analysis and just remove that one fact. What the Court of Appeals did in this case, instead of just disregarding that fact, though, was make an alternative factual finding. And in paragraph 22, it said that the SUV, based on its review of the video, the video reflects that the SUV was not, in fact, parked in the middle of the alley, but rather off to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple problems with that, Your Honors. One, the state doesn't believe that the video clearly shows that the SUV is off to the side, and the Court of Appeals doesn't explain what off to the side means. And the Court of Appeals didn't appear to search the record for reasons to sustain the circuit court's factual findings. And because the video doesn't clearly show where the SUV is, then the circuit court's factual findings were further supported by Officer Rivera's direct testimony that the circuit court found credible.
With the indulgence of my colleagues, this is the final question in my litany this morning. Really.
Okay.
What if, assume arguendo, that the video clearly showed that the evidence contradicts the finding? Then what? What is the Court of Appeals to do?
If the video is clear that a circuit court was wrong, then I think it's fine to declare a factual finding clearly erroneous. Because a video can be used as a tool to review the circuit court's factual findings, and if the video clearly shows an opposite result, then it can be clearly erroneous. But here...
Counsel, this is Justice Dallet. I am looking at the transcript. I am not seeing anywhere in this transcript where the officer who testified said that this vehicle was blocking traffic. He says it was in the alley, so traffic would have had to get around it. And then the circuit court not only can review that transcript, obviously, or the Court of Appeals can review not only that transcript, but can review the video. And then it's up to the Court of Appeals, as Justice Ann Ross Bradley was asking you, to then look at those factual findings and determine if they are, in fact, erroneous. So I'm having trouble seeing the problem here.
Justice Dallet, the Officer Rivera testified that the SUV wasn't parked off to the side. It was parked right in the alley. And he testified that it would interfere with two-way traffic. So there is support for the circuit court's finding that the SUV was somewhere improper in the alley.
Counsel, you earlier mentioned that the Court of Appeals doesn't explain what it meant by off to the side. I don't understand what that means. There's an alley, and then there's private property. Is there anything in the traffic laws, the ordinances, the statutes, that delineates an off-to-the-side portion of an alley in a city like Milwaukee?
I don't believe so, Justice Bradley. And in the alleys, like the one in this case, there are clearly places to park. There are parking slabs, there are garages, and there are places to be so that any car isn't in the way in the alley, such that traffic would have to get around it in order to pass.
And was this a one-way alley?
No.
Okay, so I watched the video too. The car is parked in the alley right next to a parking slab, as
right.
We're calling it. I understand the defendant said that he lived there, but he was not, in fact, parked in the parking slab on what he said was his property. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what was violated here in the traffic laws, a statute or a city ordinance?
We've been relying on a city ordinance, both the obstruction ordinance in Milwaukee and the blocking a driveway ordinance.
Thank you.
Counsel, this is Justice Dallet again. When he was testifying, Officer Rivera didn't mention the ordinance. He didn't mention the parking, the statutes governing parking. That is, was not any part of his testimony. And it is true, is it not, that based on this video, we're talking about a matter of seconds here. He would have had no way of knowing how long that car was there, if the person who lived there was in fact being dropped off. There's none of that in this record, right?
Correct, Justice Dallet, but an officer can have reasonable suspicion regardless of his subjective motivations as long as there's an objectively reasonable basis for the stop. So even if Rivera didn't directly testify to the parking ordinance or the obstruction ordinance at issue, that is an objectively reasonable basis for the stop, just as Judge Dugan decided in his dissent.
It's pretty black-letter law, isn't it, counsel, that the officer could be potentially wrong, but if there's a reasonable basis that the officer didn't mention, so blocking a driveway, for example, if it was actually blocking a driveway, it doesn't matter whether the officer that was what was in the officer's mind or what the officer testified about. If that is present, that would be independently sufficient enough to justify it, correct?
Correct, Justice Hagedorn.
So, and, of course, the police officer does not have to rule out potential innocent explanations for why somebody is parked in an alley.
Correct. And that goes to the Court of Appeals' second failure in this case, and it's failure to apply this court's longstanding precedent about reasonable suspicion and it being an inquiry based on the totality of the circumstances. And as this court just held in Moore, officers aren't required to rule out innocent explanations as long as there's a reasonable inference of unlawful conduct.
Parking in the wrong spot. The unlawful conduct we're talking about here. A potential parking violation that isn't even clear if it's a parking violation, because to be parked, I think you probably have to have been there for more than a couple of seconds. I'm not sure what the definition of parked is versus stopped, but... Right? So that's what we're relying on here, a parking ordinance.
Correct, Justice Dallet. And it's This court has made clear that Terry stops can occur based solely on traffic violations, non-traffic civil ordinance violations, criminal conduct. Traffic stops can occur as long as there's an objectively reasonable basis for it. And in this case, there are several, including the obstruction ordinance, the blocking a driveway ordinance, and as the circuit court held, just general reasonable suspicion of criminal conduct. So there are several ways that we can get to the initial stop of McBride being lawful, and the Court of Appeals both misapplied the clearly erroneous standard and disregarded the circuit court's findings about the SUV, and it misapplied the general Fourth Amendment principles when it didn't consider the time of night, the darkness of the alley, the fact that the SUV was completely unilluminated when Rivera encountered it, so he didn't know whether it was occupied. And then when it did consider the facts that it kept intact and thought were pertinent, it conducted the classic divide-and-conquer approach that this court rejected 2 years ago in Genesis. Instead of viewing the case as a cumulative whole, the Court of Appeals stated that high crime, the state can't justify a traffic stop based on nothing more than a recitation that a person was in a high crime area, but no one has ever argued that this was just because McBride was in a high crime area. And this court has made clear that a person's presence in a high crime area is something that can be considered in a totality of the circumstances analysis. The Court of Appeals also concluded that two people in a parked SUV without its lights on is also not suspicious. But again, there were more than those facts present. There was the time of night, the high crime area, Officer Rivera's training and experience, the fact that the SUV was unilluminated when he encountered it, and McBride's furtive movements when the spotlight shined into his SUV. So under that analysis, there should be no question that there was reasonable suspicion for the initial traffic stop if the court wants to go the route of determining this based on criminal conduct instead of a traffic violation.
The Court of Appeals and Mr. McBride both seem to suggest or argue that the officer somehow acted too quickly. How would you respond to that argument?
Police officers are often required to act quickly in situations that are tense and unclear, and it would be bad police work to require Rivera to go through a checklist of things that could be happening before he initiates a stop in a situation that could be potentially dangerous. So Officer Rivera didn't need, as I've said, Officer Rivera didn't need to dispel of those innocent explanations, and it's clear that this court has held and the United States Supreme Court has recognized that officers often have to act quickly, and there isn't a shot clock on a Terry stop of how quickly it should or shouldn't happen. If an officer has an objectively reasonable basis, he can make the stop.
And so for counsel, for people that happen to live in high crime areas like Mr. McBride, who was behind his place of residence, and they happen to be in their car at 11 o'clock at night, not 2 in the morning, not some crazy hour, they are subject to, those factors can be used as a totality of circumstances to bolster any kind of stop against them for people that happen to move around at night and who live in a high crime area.
Justice Ellett, those facts can, of course, be used in a totality of the circumstances analysis. This court has made clear that high crime is something that courts can consider. Time of night is something that courts can consider. Darkness of an area is something that courts can consider. The amount of people and the isolation of an area are things that courts can consider. And that gets to the point of the Court of Appeals failing to conduct a proper totality analysis. Here, the Court of Appeals simply disregarded several factors that it could, that it should have considered when examining the totality of the circumstances.
So don't be in a car at night, in a place that you live, if you happen to live in a high crime area, and certainly not with another person.
Justice Dallet, it's...
All of that can be used against you.
If there are other facts that lead an officer to an objectively reasonable basis for a stop, those factors can be considered.
But, you know, counsel, I know some of my colleagues have difficulty with the high crime area piece. There's been some discussion about that in various cases over the years. But maybe it's worth exploring a little bit why that might be relevant, and curious if you have any thoughts to add on to it. I mean, it seems to me that it's not just that you're in a high crime area, but it's relevant because it would help assist the officer in knowing what that officer is looking at, right? The test asks, what would a reasonable law enforcement officer reasonably suspect? We're not talking about what a reasonable lawyer would think about a situation,
right,
or even a reasonable citizen or a reasonable person who's concerned about, you know, perhaps even police conduct in a certain area. Really, the law the United States Supreme Court has told us to apply is to put ourselves in the mind of the reasonable, objective police officer who has a particular view of things. And I suppose, at least it seems to me, that a police officer is in an area where particular types of crimes might be more common than others. That's going to inform how they're going to respond to what they see. At least that's how I think through a little bit. I wonder if you have anything further to add about, you know, obviously it's not a standalone issue, and there's concerns about, potentially differential policing and those sorts of things. But I wonder if you have anything to add about why you think that's a permissible and maybe relevant component of a reasonable suspicion analysis.
I think all of your points are correct, Justice Hagedorn, and Rivera's testimony in this case informs that exact statement that you just made. He testified that he's made over 24 arrests in that area and is taking calls for shootings and drug interactions. So being in that area and being an experienced officer, he can look at things differently than a citizen can, differently than a lawyer can, and determine that the facts that are building up as he approaches this car are suspicious enough to warrant an investigation and warrant an investigative stop.
And it's pretty common, isn't it, as one of the ways drug transactions take place, for people to park and lights off in front of a home, have somebody come, sit in the passenger seat, do a transaction, and then go. That's the sort of thing, I think, that's a fact pattern I've seen in other types of cases that officers are aware of.
Correct. That's exactly what happened in Jenna's that this court decided 2 years ago. So just briefly before I run out of time, I want to emphasize that when Rivera had reasonable suspicion to stop McBride, he could then remove him from the car under Mims and Wilson. And at that point, in addition to all of the facts that had already built up, Officer Rivera observed an unlabeled prescription pill bottle in the floorboard of the SUV, right where Rivera had testified that he had seen McBride reaching around and making the furtive movements. So at that point, a reasonable officer in Rivera's position would have probable cause that McBride was committing a crime and could then arrest him for that crime and search him incident to that arrest.
Now you're going to probable cause, making a little bit of a leap from reasonable suspicion. Let's change the facts. I want to find out what's really important to you. Let's say it's 11 o'clock at night, and it is in a high crime area, and he's parked in his front driveway. Is there reasonable and articulable suspicion to believe that crime is afoot?
I think that changes the fact pattern enough that there might not be, but that's still a determination that we need to make in light of the officer's training and experience, what else he's observing. If he's just driving past somebody's driveway and sees a car there, it would be unclear in that exact hypothetical what the basis is for a stop. But I think it's important to pull back and remember that he encountered a car suspiciously parked, if not illegally parked, in an alleyway, and when he illuminated the car, he saw two people in the car, and one of the people, McBride, immediately started making furtive movements toward the floor.
What do you mean by suspiciously, if not illegal? What's suspiciously parked?
Based on Officer Rivera's testimony and the body cam footage, the car was parked in a way that it shouldn't have been, and an officer can, and Rivera could investigate that.
Yeah.
So it's
what is, you say, suspiciously, you know, mm-hmm. if not illegal. So that's two categories. I generally know what legal and illegal generally is, but I don't know what it means to be suspiciously parked, even if it isn't illegal. That would give rise to reasonable suspicion that a crime is afoot.
And the categorization of suspiciously, if not illegally, is more based on how this court wants to assess the case. If this court decides that Officer Rivera didn't have reasonable suspicion of a traffic violation, but that the circuit court's findings about the SUV were not clearly erroneous, the circuit court itself found that the SUV was parked in the alley, encountering two people in an unilluminated SUV in the alley is suspicious. So that's more of what I mean, not that the way it was parked has two different categorizations, but if this court doesn't conclude that there was reasonable suspicion for a traffic stop, or for a traffic violation, I mean, then the suspicious nature of the SUV can be added into the totality of the circumstances.
Assume not illegal. I still have a difficult time. Heaven knows the way I park my car sometimes might be considered suspicious, and I wouldn't want to be. I wouldn't want officers to think crime was afoot. So what do you mean by suspicious? So that think about that. You can answer that when you come back.
Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jill Score. I represent Dante McBride in this matter. In this case, the Court of Appeals properly applied the well-settled, clearly erroneous standard of review to the Circuit Court's factual findings and properly concluded that the seizure of Mr. McBride was not supported by reasonable suspicion. Mr. McBride challenged the constitutionality of his seizure by the Milwaukee police when he sat in the passenger seat of an SUV parked outside of his own house. In the suppression hearing, the state bore the burden of proving that this seizure was reasonable. While the officer characterized this as a high crime area, on the night of Mr. McBride's seizure, outside of his own home, there had been no calls for service, no reports of shots fired, no descriptions of suspicious activity regarding the SUV itself or Mr. McBride, the passenger within the SUV. It was a routine patrol of an alley. It took a matter of seconds for an officer to shine a police spotlight into this vehicle, get out of the squad car, pull Mr. McBride out of the passenger side, and pat him down.
Counsel, as I read the Court of Appeals majority opinion, the court seemed to take the exact approach that we said not to take in many cases, probably most recently in Genesis. They took each of the factors in the totality of circumstances test that was applied by the circuit court and ruled them out individually. I don't see any analysis in the Court of Appeals majority opinion about looking at those factors not in isolation, but as the whole picture. How would you respond to that?
Well, respectfully, I do believe that the Court of Appeals looked at several factors at a time in its analysis. I do believe it would be wrong for a court to ignore all of the factors without giving some sort of analysis to each of the factors individually, but also to look at all of the factors together. I don't believe, and I'm not aware of any authority that directs the Court of Appeals that it should not look at the factors on an individual basis. I am aware that the court is required to look at the totality of the circumstances, looking at all of the factors in total. I also believe that the Court of Appeals correctly looked at the factor of what has been characterized as the suspicious, if not illegal, manner in which this SUV was parked. And the Court of Appeals found that the Circuit Court's finding that this vehicle was, in fact, illegally parked was clearly erroneous.
Where do you see in the Court of Appeals opinion that they looked at the factors in totality? Because starting at paragraph 17, the court says, first, it is well established an individual's presence in a high crime area standing alone is insufficient to give rise to reasonable suspicion. Of course, that is a correct statement of the law in isolation. Then it moves on to the second factor, and the court says, here we do not see how the presence of two people in the parked SUV without its lights on supports reasonable suspicion. I could go on, but in the interest of not taking up the entirety of your argument time, that's how each factor is addressed. And then there's a conclusory final paragraph that says, under the totality of the circumstances, we conclude the police lacked reasonable suspicion. But I don't see how or where the court tied those factors together and said, looking at all of these factors together, it somehow fell short of reasonable suspicion.
What the Court of Appeals did was go through the various individual factors, but it didn't isolate each individual factor. It did talk about the various factors as building on one another. And contrary to the state's assertion that the court did not consider the fact that this vehicle was unlit, I believe that the Court of Appeals properly addressed that fact in discussing the fact that this happened at nighttime, and that it was upon the officer shining a light into the vehicle that the activity was observed. That is a factor which is only relevant if, in fact, it is dark out, which only happens when it is nighttime. So it's not necessarily that the court had to go, and I don't believe the court has to go through listing out each of the factors. It can, in sum, talk about the factors and, based on a reasonable analysis, conclude that the Circuit Court's findings were clearly erroneous.
Let's talk about the Court of Appeals interpretation of the video. And I asked your friend on the other side, and he made the point that the Court of Appeals doesn't really explain what off to the side means. Do you have an explanation for what that means? I don't see any distinction in the law. We have an alley and we have private property. So if the car's in the alley, it's in the alley. I don't know what off to the side means. Do you?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there's a legal explanation for it. I believe this is more of a factual finding. And in contrast with the finding by the Circuit Court that this vehicle was parked in the middle of the alley, Officer Rivera's testimony was that the car was parked in the alley. It was the Circuit Court that made the leap and inserted the word middle into that.
But does it matter? The car's in the alley. Cars can't park in an alley, right? Under ordinance?
The car is in the alley. That's correct. What we do not know is how long this car was in the alley. We do not know how long it was parked there. We do not know what the purpose of that car being there was.
Does that matter in the reasonable suspicion analysis? Because an officer on patrol couldn't possibly answer those questions, right? They come upon a car parked in the alley, lights off, shine a light, there's furtive movements. Is it your position that under those circumstances an officer should just keep going?
It depends on the circumstances, and I believe under the circumstances of this case that there was not reasonable suspicion for the officer to seize Mr. McBride in the fashion that happened. I believe the state and the circuit court made the mistake of believing that this car was parked in the middle of the alley such that it was obstructing traffic. That I do not believe is a correct finding. I believe the Court of Appeals correctly decided that this car was not parked in the middle of the alley such that it was obstructing traffic.
But does that matter? I mean, we don't have measurements of the alley, and you're not suggesting that the police officer needs to take measurements before he conducts a Terry stop, right?
I'm not.
Okay, but if a car is coming from one direction and another car is coming from the other direction, there is an obstruction if somebody's parked in the alley where they're not supposed to be parked, right?
Well, and under the facts of this case, I disagree that there was, in fact, that obstruction. Officer Rivera testified that he was, in fact, able to maneuver his squad car around this parked SUV.
Right, but if another car was coming at the time the squad is going the opposite direction, do we have anything in the record that suggests that that car would be able to pass through despite the presence of a police officer's vehicle and Mr. McBride's vehicle?
We do have the information that there was a driver in the driver's seat of that vehicle. And the circuit court is correct in concluding that it is reasonable to believe that that car was capable of being moved. It arrived there somehow, and it's reasonable to assume that it would be capable of being moved or being moved. And upon the officer shining the spotlight into the vehicle, the officer could see that there was somebody sitting right there in the driver's seat. It would be reasonable to believe that this car could be moved. Moreover, once the light shone upon the individual in the driver's seat, the reasonable suspicion that this car was parked there and essentially abandoned, left to be there, left overnight, dissipates. There's somebody still in the car. To find that this car was there parked and intended to be left there for an unknown amount of time is not a reasonable conclusion.
Counsel, I want to put aside the Court of Appeals opinion for the moment because in our review, we're not deferring to anything the Court of Appeals did, right? We're doing our own independent review of what the trial court did, correct?
Correct.
And so we start with the law that the trial court's findings are correct unless they're clearly erroneous, and it is your burden to prove they're clearly erroneous to us, correct?
Correct.
So could you be very specific and identify exactly which findings you think the trial court made that we should not accept and why?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court erroneously found that the officer's basis for the stop was a traffic violation. The manner in which the circuit court found that this vehicle was parked in the middle of the alley. The record in this case includes a video recording obtained from the officer's body-worn camera. That video clearly shows that this vehicle was not in the middle of the alley such that it was obstructing that traffic. And in addition, Officer Rivera's own testimony was that he was able to maneuver this police squad car around that parked vehicle. This vehicle was indeed occupied by a driver and thus capable of being moved.
Is that a finding that was erroneous, or are you just adding some context?
I'm saying that's not one of the,
okay.
The findings.
So the first one I think you mentioned was in the middle of the alley, wasn't in the middle of the alley.
Correct.
What other findings do you are you arguing to us are clearly erroneous?
Your Honor, the trial court erroneously relied upon the presence of an unlabeled pill bottle as a fact, as a factor in its analysis for reasonable suspicion.
I'm not talking about it's legal, right? The legal analysis and reasonable suspicion is entirely separate. So I want you to focus on just the facts, because it's your obligation to prove the trial court findings clearly erroneous. So just the facts. What facts do you think the trial court got wrong?
Well, the trial court did find that the officer was aware of that pill bottle before the officer had the reasonable suspicion to find that Mr. McBride was conducting some sort of criminal activity. That finding alone was clearly erroneous. I don't believe that the state even disputes that in its briefing.
That the officer was aware of the pill bottle before he...
Correct.
Yeah, it wasn't until after he's shown away in the car.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Any other findings that you would like to challenge? Are those the only two?
Those are the two.
Okay. If we disagree that the trial court findings are clearly erroneous, do you lose? Do you need that to win?
No. I believe that the Court of Appeals properly conducted the correct analysis of the law as applied to these facts. If we take out the suspicion surrounding the way that this car was parked, there is not enough reasonable suspicion to support Officer Rivera's seizure of Mr. McBride, and that the motion to suppress should have been granted.
Thanks.
Counsel, in response to my friend's question, we're learning that that's the way you're supposed to do it, except it's not to other colleagues, just to the attorneys along and between themselves. So, but I'm extending it. You said the finding of fact that the car was in the middle of the alleyway. It was clearly erroneous. Was there also a separate finding that the vehicle was obstructing traffic? Or not traffic, it was obstructing the flow of traffic, I guess.
That seems to be what the circuit court concluded, Your Honor. It seems that the circuit court found that this vehicle was parked in the middle of the alley and therefore obstructed or impeded the flow of traffic. It cannot be suspicious for an individual, even somebody who lives in a high crime area, to sit in a car parked off to the side in an alley without its light on. The act of reaching, which was observed by the officer after shining the spotlight into the vehicle, in combination with these factors, does not give rise to reasonable suspicion that criminal activity was afoot. There was no reasonable suspicion to remove Mr. McBride from the vehicle. Let me back up to this case is distinguishable from other case law decided by this court in the fact that the officers had no notice of criminal activity. They were not responding to any kind of call, any sort of tip or shot spot or anything of that nature that put them in this location other than what was characterized as a routine patrol.
Do you have any case law that suggests that for officers to be able to respond to a situation, they must be called to the scene?
No, Your Honor, but what I'm saying is that this court has decided in other cases, such as State versus Nimmer and State versus Jenis, where the officers were there investigating something for some other purpose, that was when they had reasonable suspicion to not only be in that area, but to have contact with the individuals that they contacted.
So you need reasonable suspicion to be in the area?
What I'm saying is you need reasonable suspicion. The officer here needed reasonable suspicion to contact Mr. McBride.
That part I get, but I'm hearing you argue you needed shots fired or you needed a reason to be there other than routine patrol.
No, I'm saying this case is distinguishable from other cases in which there were reports of shots fired or a confidential tip or something of that nature.
So how's that factor in? How's that make your argument better?
Well, Your Honor, what I'm saying is that in this case, those factors were not present. This contributes to the fact that this was not a contact by law enforcement, which was supported by reasonable suspicion.
You agree that if the car, this maybe follows up on Justice Rebecca Bradley's questions, that if the car was sitting where it was for some extended period of time, that it was unlawfully there, correct?
It would depend on the circumstances. Again, because there were two people sitting in the car,
yep.
There is an ordinance that allows for a car to be parked for the purposes of loading and unloading. So if there was more information that we had that it was not there for the purposes of loading or unloading, it's potentially in violation.
Your briefing seemed to acknowledge that, and basically your response was it's just, officer wasn't there long enough, only maybe half a minute or so. How long do you think officers need to watch a car before they can pull it over because they assume it's not temporary?
Well, and again, I believe this is a very fact-specific scenario. I don't believe that there is or should be a bright-line rule for how long an officer needs to observe a vehicle in order to find it suspicious.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is, like, if a car is in a place where it shouldn't be, it's true. There might be an innocent explanation for it. It might be temporary. But isn't that enough for a reasonable law enforcement officer to reasonably suspect at 11 o'clock at night that perhaps it's not there for a lawful purpose when it's already parked illegally and it's blocking a driveway?
Well, again, I come back to it depends on what's reasonable under the circumstances. The officer did not point to the fact that this manner in which this vehicle, the SUV, was parked, was blocking in another vehicle as informing his...
But he doesn't have to, right?
No, he doesn't.
The only question is, what would the objective... It's an objective test. It's not a subjective test.
Right.
So what... You're telling me a reasonable law enforcement officer seeing a car in a place where a car can't be... would not reasonably suspect that perhaps there's an ordinance violation here, a parking violation at issue?
It may be reasonable under the circumstances, but again, I come back to you, under the facts of this case, what officer did was not supported by reasonable suspicion. The officer and the record, the video is in the record. We're talking about a matter of mere seconds from the time the officer sees the vehicle, turns on the spotlight, exits his squad car to come around to the passenger side and make contact with Mr. McBride. I'm not proposing that there is or should be a bright line test of how long an officer needs to observe a vehicle. What I'm simply arguing to the court is that under the facts of this case, and this is very fact specific, under the facts of this case, that there was not the reasonable suspicion to support this stop.
Is it your argument that the police officer should not have shown the light into the car to see if somebody was in it or not when it's parked in the alley?
No.
Okay. And then the officer testified as soon as he turned the light on, he saw Mr. McBride reaching around his waistband and reaching down into the car. Are you saying that that doesn't give the officer at least pause? Because that's always a signal under our cases that the officer might be in danger because somebody might be reaching for a weapon. So what is your argument as to what the officer should have done after he shone the light on the car and saw those furtive movements?
Well, first of all, I believe that the record is that Mr. McBride was reaching towards his waist. I don't believe that the record reflects that Mr. McBride reached towards the floor, as has been argued. Reaching towards the waist, yes, I understand, has been characterized as a furtive movement. And what this court has looked at under State versus Johnson was that a motion by an individual sitting in a car does not automatically give rise to reasonable suspicion and authorize the seizure. Offense.
But that's where we're getting into looking at the factors in isolation. So it is that factor, the furtive movements, on top of the car being parked where it shouldn't be. And again, you concede, right, that the officer does not have an obligation under the law to rule out innocent explanations such as the loading or unloading, which of course was not happening in this situation, right?
I agree. I would just note that under the facts of this case, and again, I come back to this is very fact specific. Under the facts of this case, the officer's reasonable suspicion, his actions were not supported by objective reasonable suspicion.
Counsel, a year ago I wrote a dissent with regard to a reasonable suspicion case in State versus Green, and I, employing my highest and best math skills, said 0 plus 0 plus 0 still equals 0. Can you use that paradigm in discussing the facts of this case?
Sure. Justice Bradley, the Court of Appeals looked at where this car was parked. This seems to be the most probative factor found by the circuit court and relied upon by the state in its arguments, that where this car was parked was not illegal. It did not violate this obstructing or impeding traffic ordinance, and that it was not suspicious, that there was nothing inherently suspicious about two individuals sitting in a parked car in an alley shortly after 11 o'clock at night. That alone is zero. If we add to that that being in a high crime area alone is not enough to give rise to reasonable suspicion, again, that's zero. And relying on precedent like State versus Johnson, a movement, I'm not going to say that it's furtive because I don't believe that it is. Mr. McBride, according to the officer, made a movement towards his waist, not towards the floor or anything else. Again, if that's zero, zero plus zero is still zero.
Are you asking us to overturn our case law and adopt the analysis that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley wrote in her dissent Green case?
No, Your Honor. What I believe this
that's a good idea.
Yes. Can I answer that question?
With all due respect to Justice Bradley, no, I am not asking for anything to be overturned in this case. I believe, again, I feel like a broken record, this is a very fact-specific situation. And under the facts of this case, the Court of Appeals did not erroneously apply the clearly erroneous standard of review to the Circuit Court's factual findings. And moreover, the Court of Appeals' legal conclusions were supported by the record in this case.
I just wanted to go back to a statement you made. You said that the officer's testimony was only that he was reaching toward his waist area, but I'm reading from the transcript, and Officer Rivera said the Pastor McBride, quote, started to bend down toward his waist area and began to reach around in the vehicle. Is there anything in the record to dispute the officer's testimony?
No, there is not. I take that as it is. Had the officer said he was reaching towards the floor, I think that would be in the record. But what we have is that he was reaching towards his waistband and reaching around. I don't see that there was any mention of reaching towards the floor or the floorboards or anything like of that nature.
And we also have the officer's testimony that based on his experience and training dealing with similar search situations, those movements were, quote, consistent with someone having illegal narcotics or weapons on their person. Was there anything in the record to dispute the officer's characterization of how he viewed what he saw based on his experience and training?
I don't believe so.
Thank you.
I have just a few moments left. I would just ask that this court find that the Court of Appeals did, in fact, properly apply the clearly erroneous standard of review and did correctly conclude that the circuit court's findings should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Bella?
Suspicious parking.
To return to your question, Justice Bradley, I think it just comes down to if a car is parked in a manner that gives rise to the suspicion that it is parked improperly, that is what a suspiciously parked car would be.
Okay, and what gives rise? What manner gives rise? That's really what I'm asking about.
In this case, the SUV being parked in the middle or somewhere in the alley that it wasn't supposed to be parked.
Counsel, from my view, and I say this respectfully, facts of cases come and go, right? But a standard of review is enduring. In my mind, others may see it differently. But I'm concerned about what I hear you advancing is the standard of review. And I just want to make sure what you're arguing, or clarify what you're arguing. As you could tell, when you started your questioning, I was focusing in on, what are you saying, the standard review? And I want you to assume, and I know it's contested here, I want you to assume that the officer's video, or the cam recorder, clearly demonstrated the officer's testimony was mistaken. In that instance, are you saying, nevertheless, that as long as the officer has testimony in the record, albeit mistaken, that a court is bound to accept that testimony because it's any testimony in the record? That's what you were advancing initially.
No. If the video clearly shows, it's clear and obvious, clearly erroneous, that in this case, the SUV was parked properly, I guess, is how we can describe it. The Court of Appeals, of course, can overturn that fact as clearly erroneous.
Even though the officer has testified to facts contrary to that depicted in the video, assuming the depiction is accurate.
Correct, Justice Bradley. And I just want to touch on a couple points. Opposing counsel made, and the Court of Appeals heavily emphasized what the case wasn't about, that there wasn't a call for service, there wasn't a shot spotter, they didn't hear shots fired. But that doesn't, the facts that aren't present don't matter. What matters is the facts that are present. And to address a colloquy that you were having, Justice Bradley, about routine patrol, or maybe it was the chief, routine patrol and officers don't need a call for service. Terry itself was just routine foot patrol of a plainclothes officer who saw something suspicious occurring on a street corner. So the inception of the reasonable suspicion doctrine wasn't based on any type of call for service. It's based on the facts that the officers observe. And to get to where the SUV is parked and highlighting the dispute in this case, I pointed out in the reply brief that in around 33 to 35 seconds, when you see Rivera approaching the SUV, there are two trash cans off to his left, and to his right and toward the alley, more into the alley, is the SUV. So whether the SUV is perfectly centered in the middle of the alley doesn't matter. There is enough in the video that the question is still in dispute, and then, in this case, Officer Rivera's testimony supports the circuit court's factual findings. The maneuverability of the SUV, or the maneuverability around the SUV, also is not something that can lead to the factual findings being clearly erroneous. I can maneuver around a car that's blocking me, but that car is still blocking me. The obstruction is still occurring regardless of if I can maneuver around it. And the fact that McBride highlights that the driver was in the car ready to move the SUV if need be, highlights that the SUV is somewhere where it shouldn't be. It shouldn't matter whether the driver is there and can move it if it's somewhere where it should be. And just the Court of Appeals, and now during oral argument, McBride note that the movements seem to be something less than furtive movements, but the Court of Appeals, I see I'm out of time.
Go ahead and finish your sentence.
Thank you. The Circuit Court found the testimony that there were furtive movements credible, and that was never found to be clearly erroneous, so this Court should conclude that the movements were furtive. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Interesting oral arguments. Thank you. With respect to the class, I'll be back out here in a few minutes if you choose to stay. The marshal will let me know. But otherwise, court's adjourned. We will meet in closed conference at 11:15.